Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The Barry Morphew case, that's what we're going to be talking about here, and we're going to talk about it from a perspective of Barry's supporters. Now, this is important. Even if you think Barry is guilty or guilty as sin, or maybe guilty or kind of guilty, or maybe he had something to do with it, or maybe not, but maybe they did, but they can't prove it. Whatever your thoughts are, it's always important, no matter what the case, whether it's Barry Morphew, no matter what it may be, you always want to be able to try and see things from the other side's perspective. It will improve your own. It will. And whether that means it fortifies it more, makes it clearer, or possibly, just possibly, adds a little doubt to the possibility of where you currently sit, it's important to see it, because at the end of the day, accuracy, truth, and reality are what we're going for. Not feeling good, not just being right on a hunch, but actual facts in a case. The integrity of it. Someone's freedom, someone's future is at play. And beyond that, he's someone's father. He's someone's brother. And you may have an opinion, he's a shitty, whatever. Whatever your opinion may be, he's a person. And if he didn't do this, that's important. That is important. And if he did, that's important too. But I like trying to see things from both perspectives. Where do I sit personally? What do you think, Tony? Did he do it? Did he not? I don't know the answer to that question on this case. If I were to lean in one direction, if we got like the little needle here and like this is guilt and this is innocence, my needle's a little over this way, a little more towards guilt than innocence. But that's where I sit based on where the evidence is that we know right now. Is it 100%? Could I indict him without beyond a reasonable doubt right now? No, I could not. But that's what a trial is for. And that's what seeing the evidence is for. And I'm going to reserve my final judgment until that point. And we are not there yet. So let's try and understand things from the Barry Morphew supporter side for a moment. Might make you feel a little uncomfortable, but it's okay. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing to be uncomfortable about just because other people's opinions are slightly different than your own. It's okay. It's not a bad side of the pool. You can learn. You can grow. That's how that helps you. So let's get into this, and give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube as we go through this. Be respectful. Doesn't have to be hateful or mean. This is just, let's look at that side. Let's look at a side that many of us probably are just going, I don't get how they see it. Let's see if we can understand it from their side. Nothing wrong with that. All right. So there is something fascinating about the Barry Morphew case that rarely gets discussed with any real honesty. And it's the people who have stood by him consistently, loudly at times, quietly at others, but always firmly. I'm not talking about the internet trolls, not the
caricatures people imagine when they think of supporters, but real human beings who watched the story unfold and then walked away with the belief that Barry may not have done what he is accused of. If you actually sit with their reasoning, not from above, not with the eye roll, but from inside their point of view, it becomes clear why they feel the way they do. Their logic was built piece by piece, with every twist, every misstep, every unanswered question, every contradiction in the state's case, and every moment they saw investigators stumble at the exact moments they needed to be steady. At the heart of the mindset is something simple. They watched the first prosecution collapse in slow motion. To them, the state didn't just fail, it failed loudly, publicly, and in a way that made people in charge of the investigation look like they were building the plane while they were flying it. You don't forget that kind of thing. You don't hit reset just because a new affidavit comes out. People have long memories when it comes to institutional failure, and when the state walks into a courtroom 2 weeks before trial and effectively admits they're not ready, that damages credibility in a way you can't fix with a press release. Supporters saw early on that the case wasn't straightforward. There wasn't a crime scene. There wasn't blood in the house. There wasn't any visible sign of a struggle. There wasn't a witness who saw Suzanne leave with someone. There wasn't an audio recording of an argument turning violent. And while the lack of those things doesn't mean nothing happened, to supporters it means something important. The state didn't have the kind of slam dunk evidence that people intuitively expect in a domestic homicide. They didn't find a murder weapon. And even now, years later, they still don't definitively know where the crime occurred. When you tell supporters that the prosecution believes the killing happened in the home, they ask the obvious questions. Where's the proof? Where's the blood spatter? Where's the DNA? Where's the sign of struggle? And when the answer is that the prosecution infers those things from Barry's behavior and timeline inconsistencies, supporters dig their heels in further. And it's not to say the prosecution saying circumstantial evidence is pretty strong here. In a lot of ways, it is, but it is circumstantial. And circumstantial doesn't mean not important either. If it says it's going to snow tonight in the forecast, it got really, really chilly. You looked outside, the grass was green when you went to bed and you woke up and you saw snow everywhere. Well, there's one of two things that happened. It snowed last night because they said it was going to snow. It was cold. It likely makes sense that snow fell from the ground. That or someone from a local ski resort took the snow machine and shot it in your front yard and it's far as the eye can see. Both are possibilities. One is far likelier than the other. Then there's the truck telematics. If you want to understand where supporter skepticism comes from, start there. The state built an early timeline around the idea that Barry's truck movement, the opening and closing of the doors, the directional indicators, the digital signals sent back to the manufacturer showed suspicious activity that didn't match Barry's story, and it doesn't. But supporters looked at the tech itself and said, okay, hold on, the system isn't infallible. They pointed out that trucks send diagnostic signals. They pointed out that door sensors can be triggered by system resets or by things shifting inside the cabin or cargo area. They pointed out that investigators interpreted the data in a way that fit their theory rather than proving the theory independently. We've seen this in other cases. Data can be pretty strong in these areas. It can look pretty damning, and it may be. Or there are possibilities, or are there, where there is room for error. If there is, you have to honestly take a look at it. Either way, if the possibility for error is like next to none, then the data is probably solid. But if you can find other ways where, yeah, it does kind of do that sometimes, well, then there's probability that maybe it's not super accurate. In this case, from what we know about the vehicle data, it's some pretty strong stuff.
And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in court. These are not wild conspiracy positions. They are questions you would expect from anyone who knows the difference between calibrated forensic discipline and a consumer-grade telematics system meant to help dealerships troubleshoot complaints. And when the state amended or reinterpreted parts of the digital timeline, supporters saw it as moving the goalpost, basically, rather than refining the actual evidence. Then there's phone data. Suzanne's phone, Barry's phone, the locations, the periods of silence, the moments where trackers and signals didn't line up as neatly as the prosecution wanted them to, although they do line up pretty interestingly, I will say that, and it will be another strong point in court. Supporters are pointing to the positions of the affidavits where investigators speculate about what the phones were doing. They emphasize the word speculate, because in their minds, if a phone evidence, if it were truly definitive, investigators wouldn't have to guess about when a phone was powered off or when it lost signal or why it pinged in some places but not others. To supporters, these gaps aren't inconveniences. They're the cracks in the foundation that keep them from accepting the state's story as a closed loop. But the biggest early wedge, the thing that emotionally cemented the supporter movement, was the spy pen. The little device Suzanne planted in hopes of catching Barry talking to other women. It ended up catching her talking to another man. It's one of the most emotionally loaded pieces of evidence in the entire story. And depending how you look on it, it could point towards motive for Barry. Or it could show someone being really concerned and paranoid about someone doing the same thing they are actively doing, projecting out onto another person. But she's dead now. So how did that happen? Supporters listened to the recordings. They heard the marriage in decline. They heard strain, frustration, suspicion, emotional exhaustion. They didn't hear a man threatening violence or a woman fearing for her safety, though. What they heard was the kind of thing they've heard in their own lives, in their parents' homes, in their friends' marriages, in their own moments of relationship collapse. They were not recordings of escalating fight patterns or psychic fear. They were recordings of two people emotionally unraveling in ways that didn't fit the classic domestic violence mold. And that's not to say that it couldn't be signs of it. They're saying, what you got on tape? Not quite there. Supporters saw that distinction clearly, and it mattered to them, not because they thought the marriage was good, but because they didn't think a broken marriage automatically foretold murder. Because it doesn't. Most people get divorced and no one ends up dead. But a very small percentage do. Very small, though. It's not a, you're arguing on tape, gee, someone's going to die now. Then the first case fell apart in private, not quietly, in real time, with sanctions, delays, errors, and a dismissal that fell to supporters like confirmation that the state charged too quickly. Before the evidence was truly ready. And whether that's true or not from a legal standpoint, the perception is what shaped the psychology. It fell apart in a spectacular way. The early collapse hardened the distrust long before the body was ever found. So you have distrust in there as well. So you already don't trust the system. You have an attorney literally being disbarred for their conduct trying to prosecute this case. Literally, career gone. It's a big deal. It takes a lot to have that happen. So, when one side is doing this, more evidence comes out on try number two that they didn't have the first time. You kind of go, this is a little weird. How do we know this is, how do we even trust the basics of your evidence that you're pitching to us? But then years later, Suzanne's remains were found 50 miles from where she disappeared. Discovered not because investigators triangulated a likely dump site or traced Barry's movements or followed the data, but because another missing person search stumbled upon bones in an area investigators had already passed over. And this detail lands differently depending on who you talk to. The prosecutors,
It was a tragic but ultimately clarifying discovery that reinvigorated the case. To supporters, it was more evidence that investigators had never had command of the case in the first place. They didn't know where to look. They weren't following a coherent theory. They were crossing their fingers for a break. Supporters point out that it wasn't search and rescue professionals using forensic mapping who found Suzanne. Does that matter? I don't know. It was coincidence. To them, that matters because they believe it reveals something deeper, that investigators weren't leading the search for the truth, they were chasing it. And sometimes that's all you can do in a case. It doesn't mean that the person that you come to the conclusion of who committed it is not accurate. It just means this is what you're working with. And then came the autopsy, the confirmation, the homicide, the presence of the drug cocktail known as BAM, bupropofol, azapurine, and metomidine. I'm probably saying some of those wrong, so yeah. An exotic sedative used in wildlife settings. Exotic because it's not that common for you to have it. And supporters, again, didn't ignore it. They saw its significance. They knew it meant something. But they asked questions the prosecutors didn't answer publicly at first. How were those levels measured? How intact were the compounds after years of environmental exposure? How conclusive was the toxicology? Were the findings indicative of primary dosing? Were they traced? Were they metabolized? They asked how much was science and how much was investigative inference. And unless you're someone who reads toxicology reports for a living, these questions aren't unreasonable. Then the state revealed the needle cap in the dryer. Okay, big piece of evidence here, and it does look pretty damning. How's your credibility so far? Oh, you've already had someone disbarred? And you found this in the dryer. That's convenient. Or was it there? When you don't have credibility, when you actually have real facts that pop up and real pieces of evidence, it doesn't matter because you've already tarnished your reputation. It's the boy who cried wolf. And it can let killers go free. That's why you don't deal and you don't present things and you don't lie that are not accurate or you are not true or you don't have solid evidence to back up. The state is learning that the hard way. They reveal the needle cap in the dryer, the cap associated with the same type of sedative, the cap found with Barry's shorts. It does look rather damning. Supporters push back on the chain of custody, the contamination risk, the interpretive bias, not because they thought the needle cap meant nothing, but because they felt the state had burned through its credibility on evidence handling during the first case. If you believe investigators can make mistakes and the first case proved you can, then a single cap doesn't close the story for you. It just sharpens the questions. And let's talk about the daughters, because this is the emotional engine powering the supporter movement at its core. Macy and Mallory aren't just present. They are unwavering. They sit in court not with performative outrage, but with quiet certainty. They defend their father, not with hollow slogans, but with the posture of people who have had years to examine the darkest possibilities and have come away unconvinced. Supporters look at them and say, these two women know something the public doesn't. Maybe, maybe not. Whether that's true or not, it's the perception. And perception, as we've learned already, is powerful. To supporters, when daughters sit in every hearing, when they speak to media, when they show no hesitation, it signals a deeper truth than anything a telematics readout or an affidavit can convey. In their minds, daughters don't choose the wrong side of a murder case. Daughters don't overlook signs of danger before and afters. Daughters don't bet their lives on a man who harmed their mother. And this belief isn't irrational. It's human. And it's also flawed. I can name tons of murder cases where the daughters still stand behind the very obvious or now convicted murderers. It's human. It's not right. It's not wrong. It's human. And it doesn't reflect innocence or guilt. Now, supporters aren't a unified block. They don't all think the same thing. They believe. Barry is, some believe Barry is completely innocent. Some believe he may have been involved, but the state can't prove it. Some believe Suzanne encountered someone else. Some believe the case is unsolved, and some believe Barry is a scapegoat for investigative failure. What they share is a philosophical line they're not willing to cross. The line where inference becomes proof. They don't reject evidence. They reject the version of the evidence that relies on connections they feel the state has not demonstrated cleanly. In their minds, the case is a test of how much ambiguity the justice system will tolerate before it takes someone's freedom forever. They know how domestic homicides look when the evidence is strong. They think they do. They've seen the blood, the digital patterns, the confessions, the financial money motive trails, the wounds, the arguments overheard by neighbors. They've seen what it looks like when a clean-cut case like this is presented. But this is not a clean-cut case. When a husband kills a wife and leaves a clear trail behind. But what happens when he doesn't? What happens if he didn't do it and the state's really trying to make it look like he did? They look at this case and see something different. They see a vacuum. They see a body found far from home. They see a marriage breaking apart in ways it didn't map onto classic pre-homicide escalation. They see digital data that doesn't create a perfect straight line. And they see a husband who may be guilty. They don't deny that possibility, but they don't see a husband who the state has proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what matters. Supporters also talk about the timeline inconsistencies, not from Barry, but from investigators. They point out sections of the affidavit where investigators floated one theory in 2020, another in 2021, a modified theory after a Deer Farm sedative came up, and another shift after the body was found. And they ask, if the theory keeps changing, how confident are they really? And again, it is not illogical. When a case is built backwards from a hypothesis rather than forward from a crime scene, the hypothesis has to keep mutating as new evidence arrives. Supporters interpret that mutation the way many people would, as a sign that the underlying structure isn't solid. And let's address something that often gets ignored. Supporters are not, for the most part, saying the state is lying. They're saying the state is speculating. They're saying the evidence is circumstantial. They're saying the case is built on behavioral interpretation rather than forensic certainty. They say Barry's odd choices, disposing of trash in multiple locations, turning off his phone, having inconsistencies in his statements may be signs of guilt. Or they may be signs of a man panicking during a marital crisis, an investigation he didn't fully understand. They aren't excusing it, they're contextualizing it. And this is a part that gets lost in the noise. Supporters don't deny the possibility that Barry could be guilty. At least ones with open minds don't. They simply don't think the evidence makes that conclusion inevitable. Their guiding principle isn't, he didn't do it, it's, don't convict a man unless you can show me the whole picture, not pieces arranged to look like one. To them, this isn't a case about absolving Barry. It's a case about holding the state to a standard that matches the stakes. They look at the autopsy, the sedatives, the needle cap, the timeline gaps, the marriage issues, and they say, maybe. But maybe isn't enough. Tell me a story that fits every piece without forcing the edges. You may disagree with them. You may think the evidence is more than enough. You may think the state's theory is the most coherent explanation of what happened. But when you understand the supporters' viewpoint, you stop seeing them as fringe, and you start seeing them as people responding to a very flawed investigative arc, a very strange disappearance, a very complicated marriage, a very messy first prosecution, and a very cautious relationship with the concept of certainty. They're not fighting for Barry. They're fighting for the idea that before you take a life away, you better be damn sure and damn transparent about how you got there. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. I'm curious to get your thoughts because, look, there's a very strong case against Barry. And a very bungled investigation and a very bungled first attempt at prosecuting him as well. And it's not crazy to think that a jurisdiction that really has mud on their face doesn't get more vindictive and doesn't get more determined to try and prove that they are right, even when they are wrong.
I'm not saying that's what they're doing, but I'm not saying it hasn't happened in the past. What's going on? I don't know. I want to hear your thoughts in the comment section. And give me something more than just, he's guilty or he's innocent. Tell me why. Either way is fine. That's how we learn. That's how we understand each other's points of view and have conversations. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi on YouTube is where you find us. Please do check that out. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.